We would be better served as communicators and decision makers if we thought less about whether we are confident in our beliefs and more about how confident we are. Instead of thinking of confidence as all or nothing, I'm confident or I'm not confident, our expression of our confidence would then capture all the shades of gray in between. When we express our beliefs to others or just to ourselves as part of our internal decision-making dialogue, they don't generally come with qualifications. What if, in addition to expressing what we believe, we also rated our level of confidence about the accuracy of our belief on a scale of 0 to 10? 0 would mean we are certain a belief is not true. 10 would mean we are certain that our belief is true. A 0 to 10 scale translates directly to percentages. If you think the belief rate's a 3, that means you are 30% sure the belief is accurate. A 9 means you are 90% sure. So instead of saying to ourselves, Citizen Kane won the Oscar for Best Picture, we would say, I think Citizen Kane won the Oscar for Best Picture, but I'm only a 6 on that. Or, I'm 60% that Citizen Kane won the Oscar for Best Picture. That means your level of certainty is such that 40% of the time it will turn out Citizen Kane did not win the Best Picture Oscar. Forcing ourselves to express how sure we are of our beliefs brings to plain sight the probabilistic nature of those beliefs. That what we believe is almost never 100% or 0% accurate, but rather somewhere in between. In a similar vein, the number can reflect several different kinds of uncertainty. I'm 60% confident that Citizen Kane won Best Picture reflects that our knowledge of this past event is incomplete. I'm 60% confident that the flight from Chicago will be late incorporates a mix of our incomplete knowledge and the inherent uncertainty in predicting the future. For example, the weather might intervene or there might be an unforeseen mechanical issue. We can also express how confident we are by thinking about the number of plausible alternatives and declaring that range. For example, if I am stating a belief about what age Elvis died, I might say somewhere between age 40 and 47. I know he died in his 40s, and I remember that it was his earlier 40s, so for me, this is the range of plausible alternatives. The more we know about a topic, the better the quality of information we have, the tighter the range of plausible alternatives. When it comes to predictions, the plausible range of outcomes would also be tighter when there is less luck involved. The less we know about a topic, or the more luck involved, the wider our range. We can declare how sure we are whether we are thinking about a particular fact or a set of facts, like dinosaurs were herd animals, a prediction, like I think there is life on other planets, or how the future will turn out given some decision we make, like I think I will be happier if I move to Des Moines than I am where I live now, or I think the company will be better off if we fire the president. These are all beliefs of differing sorts. Incorporating uncertainty into the way we think about our beliefs comes with many benefits. By expressing our level of confidence in what we believe, we are shifting our approach to how we view the world. Acknowledging uncertainty is the first step in measuring it and narrowing it. Incorporating uncertainty in the way we think about what we believe creates open-mindedness, moving us closer to a more objective stance toward information that disagrees with us. We are less likely to succumb to motivated reasoning since it feels better to make small adjustments in degrees of certainty instead of having to grossly downgrade from right to wrong. When confronted with new evidence, it is a very different narrative to say, I was 58%, but now I'm 46%. That doesn't feel nearly as bad as, I thought I was right, but now I'm wrong. Our narrative of being a knowledgeable, educated, intelligent person who holds quality opinions isn't compromised when we use new information to calibrate our beliefs, compared with having to make a full-on reversal. This shifts us away from treating information that disagrees with us as a threat, as something we have to defend against, making us better able to truth-seek. When we work toward belief calibration, we become less judgmental of ourselves. Incorporating percentages or ranges of alternatives into the expression of our beliefs means that our personal narrative no longer hinges on whether we were wrong or right, but on how well we incorporate new information to adjust the estimate of how accurate our beliefs are. There is no sin in finding out there is evidence that contradicts what we believe. The only sin is in not using that evidence as objectively as possible to refine that belief going forward. Declaring our uncertainty and our beliefs to others makes us more credible communicators. We assume that if we don't come off as 100% confident, others will value our opinions less. The opposite is usually true. If one person expresses a belief as absolutely true and someone else expresses a belief by saying, I believe this to be true, but I'm 80% on it, who are you more likely to believe? The fact that the person is expressing their confidence as less than 100% signals that they are trying to get at the truth, that they have considered the quantity and quality of their information with thoughtfulness and self-awareness. And thoughtful and self-aware people are more believable. Expressing our level of confidence also invites people to be our collaborators. As I said, most of us don't live our lives in poker rooms, where it is more socially acceptable to challenge a peer who expresses an opinion we believe to be inaccurate to a wager. Outside of the poker room, when we declare something as 100% fact, others might be reluctant to offer up new and relevant information that would inform our beliefs for two reasons. First, they might be afraid that they are wrong and so won't speak up, worried they will be judged for that by us or themselves. Second, even if they are very confident their information is high quality, they might be afraid of making us feel bad or judged. By saying I'm 80% and thereby communicating we aren't sure, we open the door for others to tell us what they know. They realize they can contribute without having to confront us by saying or implying you're wrong. Admitting we are not sure is an invitation for help in refining our beliefs, and that will make our beliefs much more accurate over time as we are more likely to gather relevant information. Expressing our beliefs this way also serves our listeners. We know that our default is to believe what we hear without vetting the information too carefully. If we communicate to our listeners that we are not 100% on what we are saying, they are less likely to walk away having been infected by our beliefs. Expressing the belief is uncertain signals to our listeners that the belief needs further vetting, that step three is still in progress. When scientists publish results of experiments, they share with the rest of their community their methods of gathering and analyzing the data itself, and their confidence in that data. That makes it possible for others to assess the quality of the information being presented, systematized through peer review before publication. Confidence in the results is expressed through both p-values, the probability one would expect to get the result that was actually observed, akin to declaring your confidence on a scale of 0 to 10, and confidence intervals, akin to declaring the range of plausible alternatives. Scientists, by institutionalizing the expression of uncertainty, invite their community to share relevant information and to test and challenge the results and explanations. The information that gets shared back might confirm, disconfirm, or refine published hypotheses. The goal is to advance knowledge rather than affirm what we already believe. That is why science advances at a fast clip. In a collection of his short works, The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, legendary physicist Richard Feynman encapsulated this way that scientists communicate uncertainty and how they strive to avoid the extremes of right and wrong when he said, statements of science are not of what is true and what is not true, but statements of what is known to different degrees of certainty. Every one of the concepts of science is on a scale graduated somewhere between, but not at either end of absolute falsity or absolute truth. By communicating our own uncertainty when sharing beliefs with others, we are inviting the people in our lives to act like scientists with us. This advances our beliefs at a faster clip, because we miss out on fewer opportunities to get new information, information that would help us to calibrate the beliefs we have. Acknowledging that decisions are bets based on our beliefs, getting comfortable with uncertainty, and redefining right and wrong are integral to a good overall approach to decision-making. But I don't expect that having dumped all of these concepts in your lap, you should somehow know the best way to use them. These patterns are so ingrained in our thinking that it takes more than knowing the problem or even having the right outlook to overcome the irrationalities that hold us back. What I've done so far, really, is identify the target. Now that we're facing in the right direction, thinking in bets is a tool to be somewhat better at hitting it. Chapter 3. Bet to Learn. Fielding the Unfolding Future. Nick the Greek and Other Lessons from the Crystal Lounge. When I first started playing poker, I lived in Columbus, Montana, population 1,200. The nearest poker game was 40 miles away in downtown Billings, in the basement of a bar called the Crystal Lounge. Every day, I drove those 40 miles, arriving by early afternoon. I would play until the evening and drive home. The game was filled with characters out of a cliched vision of Montana. Ranchers and farmers killing time in the off-season, filling the basement room with smoke wafting over the brims of their cowboy hats. It was 1992, but it could just as easily have been 1952 from the decor and the grizzled countenances of the locals. The only thing suggesting that John Wayne wasn't going to mosey on in was a handful of misfits, including me, a woman, and the youngest player by a few decades on the lam from defending my dissertation at the University of Pennsylvania, and a player named Nick the Greek. If your name is Nick, you come from Greece, and you gamble, they're gonna call you Nick the Greek, as sure as they'll call you Tiny if you weigh more than 350 pounds. And yes, there was a guy named Tiny, real name Elwood, who regularly played in the game. This Nick the Greek was of the small-time Billings variety. He was the general manager of the hotel across the street, having gotten transferred from Greece by the hotel chain. He left work for a couple of hours every afternoon, like clockwork, to play in the game. Nick the Greek had formed an unusual set of beliefs that guided his poker decisions. I knew this because he described them to me and the other players at length, using the results of particular hands to punctuate his points. He fixated on the relatively common belief that the element of surprise was important in poker. Don't be predictable, mix up your play, that sort of stuff. Then he jacked it up on steroids. To him, a starting pair of aces, the mathematically best two cards you can get dealt, was the worst hand because everyone predictably played it. They always expect you to have aces. You get killed with that hand. By that logic, he explained, the very best two starting cards to play were the mathematically weakest two cards you could receive, a seven and a deuce of different suits, a hand almost any player avoids. I bet you never saw it coming, he would say when he turned over that hand and won a pot. And because he played seven deuce all the time, occasionally the stars would line up and he'd win. I also remember times when he threw away a pair of aces, face up, at the first sign of a bet. Never mind that he was compromising a vital element of his strategy of subterfuge by constantly showing and telling us this was what he was doing. Given that he had such an entrenched set of beliefs, it's not surprising that he didn't see the incongruity. Nick the Greek, needless to say, rarely came out ahead. Yet he never changed his strategy, often complaining about his bad luck when he lost, though never in a bitter way. He was a friendly guy, pleasant to play with, the perfect poker opponent. I tried to time my daily arrivals so I'd be in the game when he made his afternoon appearance. One day, Nick the Greek didn't show up to the game. When I asked where he was, another player muttered, confidentially, though it seemed everyone in the game already knew about this, "Oh, he got sent back." "Sent back," I said. "Yeah, to Greece. They deported him." I can't say that Nick the Greek's deportation was the result of his wacky poker beliefs, but I have my suspicions. Other players speculated that he went broke or dipped into the till at the hotel or lost his work visa because he was playing poker every day on company time. I can say that Nick the Greek lost a lot of money based on his beliefs, or more accurately, because he ignored lots of feedback that his strategy was a losing one. He eventually went broke because he didn't recognize learning opportunities as they arose. If Nick the Greek were unique in his resistance to learning from the outcomes he was having at the poker table, I suppose he would just be a footnote for me, a funny story of a guy unique in his ability to hold tight to his strategy despite that strategy resulting in a lot of losing. But while an extreme case to be sure, Nick the Greek wasn't all that unique. And that was a puzzle for me. I was taught, as all psychology students are, that learning occurs when you get lots of feedback tied closely in time to decisions and actions. If we took that at face value, poker would be an ideal learning environment. You make a bet, get an immediate response from opponents, and win or lose the hand with real money consequences, all within minutes. So why was Nick the Greek, who had been playing for years, unable to learn from his mistakes? Why was a novice like me cleaning up in the game? The answer is that while experience is necessary to becoming an expert, it's not sufficient. Experience can be an effective teacher, but clearly only some students listen to their teachers. The people who learn from experience improve, advance, and with a little bit of luck become experts and leaders in their fields. I benefited from adopting the learning habits of some of the phenomenal poker players I was exposed to along the way. We can all benefit from those practical strategies to become better decision makers. Thinking in bets can help us get there. But before getting to the solutions, we must first understand the problem. What are the obstacles in our way that make learning from experience so difficult? We all clearly have a desire to reach our long-term goals. Listening to what our outcomes have to teach us is necessary to do that. So what is systematically getting in the way? Outcomes are feedback. We can't just absorb experiences and expect to learn. As novelist and philosopher Aldous Huxley recognized, experience is not what happens to a man. It is what a man does with what happens to him. There is a big difference between getting experience and becoming an expert. That difference lies in the ability to identify when the outcomes of our decisions have something to teach us and what that lesson might be. Any decision, whether it's putting $2 on count to change at the racetrack or telling your kids they can eat whatever they want, is a bet on what will likely create the most favorable future for us. The future we have bet on unfolds as a series of outcomes. We bet on staying up late to watch the end of a football game, and we sleep through our alarm, wake up tired, get to work late, and get reprimanded by the boss. Or we stay up late and any of the myriad other outcomes follows, including waking up perfectly on time and making it to work early. Whichever future actually unfolds, when we decide to stay up late to see the end of the game, we are making a bet that we will be happier in the future for having seen the final play. We bet on moving to Des Moines and we find our dream job, meet the love of our life, and take up yoga. Or like John Hennigan, we move there, hate it within 2 days, and have to buy our way home for $15,000. We bet on firing a division president or calling a pass play, and the future unfolds as it does. Look at the diagram called Betting on a Future in the PDF included with this audiobook. There you'll see a representation of this concept, where you see that beliefs inform our bets, which then result in a set of outcomes. Now, as the future unfolds into this set of outcomes, we are faced with another decision. Why did something happen the way it did? How we figure out what, if anything, we should learn from an outcome becomes another bet. As outcomes come our way, figuring out whether those outcomes were caused mainly by luck or whether they were the predictable result of particular decisions we made is a bet of great consequence. If we determine our decisions drove the outcome, we can feed the data we get following those decisions back into belief formation and updating, creating a learning loop. Please refer to the diagram Learning Loop 1 on your PDF to see a representation of this. We have the opportunity to learn from the way the future unfolds to improve our beliefs and decisions going forward. The more evidence we get from experience, the less uncertainty we have about our beliefs and choices. Actively using outcomes to examine our beliefs and bets closes the feedback loop, reducing uncertainty. This is the heavy lifting of how we learn. Ideally, our beliefs and our bets improve with time as we learn from experience. Ideally, the more information we have, the better we get at making decisions about which possible future to bet on. Ideally, as we learn from experience, we get better at assessing the likelihood of a particular outcome given any decision, making our predictions about the future more accurate. As you may have guessed, when it comes to how we process experience, ideally doesn't always apply. Learning might proceed in a more ideal way if life were more like chess than poker. The connection between outcome quality and decision quality would be clearer because there would be less uncertainty. The challenge is that any single outcome can happen for multiple reasons. The unfolding future is a big data dump that we have to sort and interpret, and the world doesn't connect the dots for us between outcomes and causes. If a patient comes into a doctor's office with a cough, the doctor must work backward from that one symptom, that one outcome of a possible disease process, to decide among the multiple reasons the patient might have that cough. Is it because of a virus, bacteria, cancer, a neurological disorder? Because a cough looks roughly the same whether it is from cancer or a virus, working backward from the symptom to the cause is difficult. The stakes are high. Misdiagnose the cause and the patient might die. That is why doctors require years of training to properly diagnose patients. When the future coughs on us, it is hard to tell why. Imagine calls to a customer by two salespeople from the same company. In January, Joe pitches the company's products and gets $1,000 in orders. In August, Jane calls on the same customer and gets $10,000 in orders. What gives? Was it because Jane is a better salesperson than Joe? Or was it because the company updated its product line in February? Did a low-cost competitor go out of business in April? Or is the difference in their success due to any of a variety of other unconsidered reasons? It's hard to know why because we can't go back in time and run the controlled experiment where Joe and Jane switch places. And the way the company sorts this outcome can affect decisions on training, pricing, and product development. This problem is top of mind for poker players. Most poker hands end in a cloud of incomplete information. One player bets, no one calls the bet, the bettor is awarded the pot, and no one is required to reveal their hidden cards. After those hands, the players are left guessing why they won or lost the hand. Did the winner have a superior hand? Did the loser fold the best hand? Could the player who won the hand have made more money if they chose a different line of play? Could the player who lost have made the winner forfeit if they chose to play the hand differently? In answering these questions, none of the players knows what the cards their opponent actually held were, or how the players would have reacted to a different sequence of betting decisions. How poker players adjust their play from experience determines their future results. How they fill in all those blanks is a vitally important bet on whether they get better at the game. We are good at identifying the ER goals we want to pursue: better, smarter, richer, healthier, whatever. But we fall short in achieving our ER because of the difficulty in executing all the little decisions along the way to our goals. The bets we make on when and how to close the feedback loop are part of the execution. All those in-the-moment decisions about whether something is a learning opportunity. To reach our long-term goals, we have to improve at sorting out when the unfolding future has something to teach us, when to close the feedback loop. And the first step to doing this well is in recognizing that things sometimes happen because of the other form of uncertainty, luck. Luck versus skill, fielding outcomes. The way our lives turn out is the result of two things, the influence of skill and the influence of luck. For the purposes of this discussion, any outcome that is the result of our decision-making is in the skill category. If making the same decision again would predictably result in the same outcome, or if changing the decision would predictably result in a different outcome, then the outcome following that decision was due to skill. The quality of our decision-making was the main influence over how things turned out. If, however, an outcome occurs because of things that we can't control, like the actions of others, the weather, or our genes, the result would be due to luck. If our decisions didn't have much impact on the way things turned out, then luck would be the main influence. When a golfer hits a tee shot, where the ball lands is the result of the influence of skill and luck, whether it's a first-time golfer or Rory McIlroy. The elements of skill, those things directly in the golfer's control that influence the outcome, include club choice, setup, and all the detailed mechanics of the golf swing. Elements of luck include a sudden gust of wind, somebody yelling their name as they swing, the ball landing in a divot or hitting a sprinkler head, the age of the golfer, the golfer's genes, and the opportunities they received or didn't receive up to the moment of the shot. An outcome like losing weight could be the direct result of a change in diet or increased exercise, skill, or a sudden change in our metabolism or a famine, luck. We could get in a car crash because we didn't stop at a red light, skill, or because another driver ran a red light, luck. A student could do poorly on a test because they didn't study, skill, or because the teacher is mean, luck. I can lose a hand of poker because I made poor decisions applying the skill elements of the game poorly, or because the other player got lucky. Chalk up an outcome to skill, and we take credit for the result. Chalk up an outcome to luck, and it wasn't in our control. For any outcome, we are faced with this initial sorting decision. That decision is a bet on whether the outcome belongs in the luck bucket or the skill bucket. This is where Nick the Greek went wrong. Check the PDF for the diagram labeled Learning Loop 2 to see a representation of the addition of luck into the equation. Think about this like we're an outfielder catching a fly ball with runners on base. Fielders have to make in-the-moment game decisions about where to throw the ball. Hit the cutoff man, throw behind a base runner, throw out an advancing base runner. Where the outfielder throws after fielding the ball is a bet. We make similar bets about where to quote-unquote throw an outcome, into the skill bucket, in our control, or the luck bucket, outside of our control. This initial fielding of outcomes, if done well, allows us to focus on experiences that have something to teach us, skill, and ignore those that don't, luck. Get this right, and with experience, we get closer to whatever ER we are striving for. Better, smarter, healthier, happier, wealthier, etc. It is hard to get this right. Absent omniscience, it is difficult to tell why anything happened the way it did. The bet on whether to field outcomes into the luck or skill bucket is difficult to execute because of ambiguity. Working backward is hard, the Snackwells phenomenon. In the 90s, millions of people jumped on the Snackwells bandwagon. Nabisco developed these devil's food cookies as a leading product to take advantage of the now discredited belief that fat, not sugar, makes you fat. Foods made with less fat were, at the time, considered healthier. With the blessing of the U.S. government, companies swapped in sugar for fat as a flavoring ingredient. Snackwells came in a green package, the color associated with low fat and therefore healthy, like spinach. For all those people trying to lose weight or make healthier snacking choices, Snackwells were a delicious godsend. Snackwells eaters bet their health on substituting these cookies for other types of snacks, like, say, cashews, which are high in fat. You could ingest sugar-laden Snackwells by the box because sugar wasn't the enemy. Fat was the enemy, and the packaging screamed, low fat. Of course, we know now that obesity rose significantly during the low-fat craze. Michael Pollan used the phrase Snackwells phenomenon in describing people increasing their consumption of something that has less of a bad ingredient. As those Snackwells eaters gained weight, it wasn't easy for them to figure out why. Should the weight gain be fielded into the skill bucket? Use this feedback that their belief about the health value of Snackwells was inaccurate? Or was the weight gain due to bad luck, like a slow metabolism or something else that wasn't their fault or at least didn't have to do with their choice to eat Snackwells? If the weight gain got fielded into the luck bucket, it wouldn't be a signal to alter the choice to eat Snackwells. Looking back now, it seems obvious how the weight gain should have been fielded. But it is only obvious once you know that Snackwells are an unhealthy choice. We have the benefit of 20 years of new research, more and better quality information about what causes weight gain. The folks on the low-fat bandwagon had only their weight gain to learn from. The cards remain concealed. Working backward from the way things turn out isn't easy. We can get to the same health outcome, weight gain, by different routes. One person might choose Snackwells. Another might choose Oreos, also a Nabisco product, developed by the same person who invented Snackwells. A third might choose lentils and kale. If all three people gain weight, how can any of them figure it out for sure? Outcomes don't tell us what's our fault and what isn't, what we should take credit for and what we shouldn't. Unlike in chess, we can't simply work backward from the quality of the outcome to determine the quality of our beliefs and decisions. This makes learning from outcomes a pretty haphazard process. A negative outcome could be a signal to go in and examine our decision-making. That outcome could also be due to bad luck, unrelated to our decision, in which case treating that outcome as a signal to change future decisions would be a mistake. A good outcome could signal that we made a good decision. It could also mean that we got lucky, In which case, we would be making a mistake to use that outcome as a signal to repeat that decision in the future. When Nick the Greek won with a 7 and a deuce, he fielded that outcome into the skill bucket, taking credit for his brilliant strategy. When he lost with that hand, a much more common occurrence, he wrote it off as bad luck. His fielding error meant he never questioned his beliefs, no matter how much he lost. We're all like Nick the Greek sometimes. Uncertainty, luck and hidden information gave him the leeway to make fielding errors about why he was losing. We all face uncertainty, and we all make fielding errors. Rats get tripped up by uncertainty in a way that should appear very familiar to us. Classical stimulus response experiments have shown that the introduction of uncertainty drastically slows learning. When rats are trained on a fixed reward schedule, for example, a pellet for every 10th press of a lever, they learn pretty fast to press that lever for food. If you withdraw the reward, the lever pressing behavior is quickly extinguished. The rats figure out that no more food is on its way. But when you reward rats on a variable or intermittent reinforcement schedule, a pellet that comes on average every 10th lever press, that introduces uncertainty. The average number of lever presses for the reward is the same, but the rat could get a reward on the next press or not for 30 presses. In other words, the rats are rewarded in the way humans usually are, having no way to know with certainty what will happen on the next try. When you withdraw the reward from those rats, the lever pressing behavior extinguishes only after a very long time of fruitless lever pressing, sometimes thousands of tries. We might imagine the rats thinking, I bet the next lever press will get me a pellet. I've just been getting unlucky. I'm due. Actually, we don't even have to imagine this. We can hear it if we listen to what people say while they play slot machines. Slot machines operate on a variable payoff system. It's no wonder that despite those machines being among the worst bets in the casino, the banks of slot machines in a casino are packed. In the end, our rat brains dominate. If this all doesn't seem difficult enough, outcomes are rarely all skill or all luck. Even when we make the most egregious mistakes and get appropriately negative outcomes, luck plays a role. For every drunk driver who swerves into a ditch and flips his car, there are several who swerve harmlessly across multi-lane highways. It might feel like the drunk driver in the ditch deserved that outcome, but the luck of the road conditions and presence or absence of other drivers also played a role. When we do everything right, like drive through a green light perfectly sober and live to tell the tale, there is also an element of luck. No one else simultaneously ran a red light and hit us. There wasn't a patch of ice on the road to make us lose control of our vehicle. We didn't run over a piece of debris and blow a tire. When we field our outcomes as the future unfolds, we always run into this problem. The way things turn out could be the result of our decisions, luck, or some combination of the two. Just as we are almost never 100% wrong or right, outcomes are almost never 100% due to luck or skill. Learning from experience doesn't offer us the orderliness of chess, or for that matter, folding and sorting laundry. Getting insight into the way uncertainty trips us up, whether the errors we make are patterned, hint, they are, and what motivates those errors, should give us clues for figuring out achievable strategies to calibrate the bets we make on our outcomes. If it weren't for luck, I'd win every one. Just as with motivated reasoning, our fielding errors aren't random. They are, borrowing from psychologist and behavioral economist Dan Ariely's best-selling book, Predictably Irrational. The way we field outcomes is predictably patterned. We take credit for the good stuff and blame the bad stuff on luck so it won't be our fault. The result is that we don't learn from experience well. Self-serving bias is the term for this pattern of fielding outcomes. Psychologist Fritz Heider was a pioneer in studying how people make luck and skill attributions about the results of their behavior. He said we study our outcomes like scientists, but like naive scientists. When we figure out why something happened, we look for a plausible reason, but one that also fits our wishes, Heider said. It is usually a reason that flatters us, puts us in a good light, and it is imbued with an added potency by the attribution. Our capacity for self-deception has few boundaries. Look at the reasons people give for their accidents on actual auto insurance forms. I collided with a stationary truck coming the other way. A pedestrian hit me and went under my car. The guy was all over the road. I had to swerve a number of times before I hit him. An invisible car came out of nowhere, struck my car, and vanished. The pedestrian had no idea which direction to run, so I ran over him. The telephone pole was approaching. I was attempting to swerve out of its way when it struck my car. I lifted these examples from an article by Stanford Law professor and social psychologist Robert McCune, and repeat them without guilt. First, they are incredibly amusing and informative. The greater crime would be not sharing them. Second, McCune acknowledged that he got them from the book Anguished English, written by my father, Richard Lederer. McCune studied accounts of auto accidents and found that in 75% of accounts, the victims blamed someone else for their injuries. In multiple vehicle accidents, 91% of drivers blame someone else. Most remarkably, McCune found that in single vehicle accidents, 37% of drivers still found a way to pin the blame on someone else. We can't write this off to lack of self-knowledge by a few bad drivers. John von Neumann, considered a terror on the roads of Princeton, New Jersey, once offered this explanation after smashing his car. I was proceeding down the road. The trees on the right were passing me in orderly fashion at 60 miles per hour. Suddenly, one of them stepped out in my path. Boom! This predictable fielding error is probably the single most significant problem for poker players. I watched it firsthand with Nick the Greek at the Crystal Lounge. When he lost with 7-deuce, it was because he got unlucky that time. When he won playing those cards, it was because his plan of surprise attack was so brilliant. Offloading the losses to luck and onboarding the wins to skill meant he persisted in overestimating the likelihood of winning with 7-deuce. He kept betting on a losing future. And this is not confined to Nick the Greeks of the small-time Billings variety. Phil Hellmuth, the biggest winner in World Series of Poker history, 14 championship bracelets and counting, famously fell prey to this fielding error. After getting eliminated from a televised poker tournament, Hellmuth said on camera to ESPN, "If it weren't for luck, I'd win every one." This line has become legend in the poker world. It was even the basis for a song, "I'd Win Every Time If It Wasn't for Luck," in All In, the poker musical, a show based on Phil's life. When the ESPN episode aired, there was a collective gasp in the poker community. After all, Phil is saying that if the luck element were eliminated from poker, if he were playing chess, his poker skills are so superior that he would win every tournament he entered. So clearly, any negative outcomes are due to luck, and any positive outcomes are the result of his superior skill. Poker players may have gasped, but the only difference between Phil and everyone else is that he said this out loud and on television. Most of us just have the sense to keep the sentiment to ourselves, especially when the cameras and mics are on. But trust me, we are all vulnerable to the exact same thinking. I certainly am not exempt. When I was playing poker, I did my share of taking credit for winning and complaining about bad luck when I lost. It's a fundamental urge. I've been conscious of that tendency in all areas of my life. Remember, we can know it's a visual illusion, but that doesn't keep us from still seeing it. Self-serving bias has immediate and obvious consequences for our ability to learn from experience. Blaming the bulk of our bad outcomes on luck means we miss opportunities to examine our decisions to see where we can do better. Taking credit for the good stuff means we will often reinforce decisions that shouldn't be reinforced and miss opportunities to see where we could have done better. To be sure, some of the bad stuff that happens is mainly due to luck. And some of the good stuff that happens is mainly due to skill. I just know that that's not true all the time. 100% of our bad outcomes aren't because we got unlucky, and 100% of our good outcomes aren't because we are so awesome. Yet that is how we process the future as it unfolds. The predictable pattern of blaming the bad stuff on the world and taking credit for the good stuff is by no means limited to poker or car accidents. It's everywhere. When Chris Christie participated in a debate before the Republican presidential primary in Iowa in early 2016, He played the part of behavioral psychologist in his attack on Hillary Clinton's response to the tragic outcome in Benghazi. She refuses to be held accountable for anything that goes wrong. If it had gone right, believe me, she would have been running around to be able to take credit for it, end quote. Whether or not the accusation is correct, Christie certainly got the human tendency right. We take credit for good things and deflect blame for bad things. Ironically, only minutes earlier, he had offered a pretty competitive example of the bias in himself. When asked by the moderator if the GOP should take a chance on nominating him in light of Bridgegate, he answered, "Sure, because there's been three different investigations that have proven that I knew nothing." Then he added, "And let me tell you something else. I inherited a state in New Jersey that was downtrodden and beaten by liberal Democratic policies, high taxes, high regulation. And this year, in 2015, New Jersey had the best year of job growth that our state has ever had in the last 15 years. That's because we've put conservative policies in place." That's a pretty fast pivot from "that bad outcome isn't my fault" to "and let me tell you the good outcome that I can take credit for." I described this pattern during an address to a meeting of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers. One lawyer in the audience rushed to tell me after the speech about a senior partner he had trained under when he was first out of law school. "You won't believe how on point this is, Annie. I assisted this partner at several trials, and at the end of each day, he would analyze the witness testimony the same way. If the witness helped our case, he would say, 'You see how well I prepared that witness? When you know how to prepare a witness, you get the results you want.' If the witness hurt our case, he would tell me, 'That guy refused to listen to me.' And it never varied." I'm betting any parent of a school-aged child knows this. On occasions when my kids have done poorly on a test, it seems to never have been because they didn't study. "The teacher doesn't like me. Everybody did poorly. The teacher put material on the test we didn't cover in class. You can ask anyone." Self-serving bias is a deeply embedded and robust thinking pattern. Understanding why this pattern emerges is the first step to developing practical strategies to improve our ability to learn from experience. These strategies encourage us to be more rational in the way we field outcomes, fostering open-mindedness and considering all the possible causes of an outcome, not just the ones that flatter us. All-or-nothing thinking rears its head again. Black-and-white thinking, uncolored by the reality of uncertainty, is a driver of both motivated reasoning and self-serving bias. If our only options are being 100% right or 100% wrong, with nothing in between, then information that potentially contradicts a belief requires a total downgrade, from right all the way to wrong. There is no somewhat less sure option in an all-or-nothing world. So we ignore or discredit the information to hold steadfast in our belief. Both of these biases cause us to see our outcomes through the equivalent of a funhouse mirror. The reflection distorts reality, maximizing the appearance of our skill and good outcomes. For bad outcomes, it makes skill all but disappear, while luck looms giant. Just as with motivated reasoning, self-serving bias arises from our drive to create a positive self-narrative. In that narrative, taking credit for something good is the same as saying we made the right decision. And being right feels good. Likewise, thinking that something bad was our fault means we made a wrong decision. And being wrong feels bad. When our self-image is at stake, we treat our fielding decisions as 100% or 0%. Right versus wrong. Skill versus luck. Our responsibility versus outside our control. There are no shades of gray. Fielding outcomes with the goal of promoting our self-narrative and doing it in an all-or-nothing fashion alters our ability to make smart bets about why the future unfolded in a particular way. Learning from experience is difficult and sometimes impossible with this kind of biased, broad-brush thinking. Outcomes are rarely the result of our decision quality alone or chance alone. And outcome quality is not a perfect predictor of the influence of luck or skill. When it comes to self-serving bias, we act as if our good outcomes are perfectly correlated to good skill, and our bad outcomes are perfectly correlated to bad luck. This is a systematic bias, not a guarantee that we always grab credit or always deflect blame. There are some people, to be sure, who exhibit the opposite of self-serving bias, treating everything bad that happens as their fault, and attributing anything good in their lives to luck. This pattern is much rarer. And in addition to being a potential symptom of depression, the pattern isn't any better because it is equally inaccurate. All bad things can't be your fault, and all good things can't be due to luck, just as the reverse can't be true. Whether it is a poker hand, an auto accident, a football call, a trial outcome, or a business success, there are elements of luck and skill in virtually any outcome. That the motivation to update our self-image in a positive way underlies self-serving bias gives us an idea of where we might look for solutions to overcome the bias. Maybe we could stop clinging to ego, giving up on that need to have a positive narrative of our lives. Maybe we could still drive a positive narrative, but instead of updating through credit and blame, we could get off on striving to be more objective and open-minded in assessing the influence of luck and skill on our outcomes. Maybe we could put in the time and hard work to retrain the way we process results, moving toward getting our positive self-image updates from accurate fielding, from truth-seeking. Or maybe we could detour around the obstacles altogether by finding a workaround that doesn't require us to address self-serving bias at all. People watching. One could conceivably argue that maybe self-serving bias isn't such a big deal because we can learn from other people's experience. Maybe the solution that has evolved is to compensate for the obstacles in learning from our own experience by watching other people do stuff. There are more than 7 billion other people on the planet who do stuff all the time. As Yogi Berra said, you can observe a lot by watching. Watching is an established learning method. There is an entire industry devoted to collecting other people's outcomes. When you read the Harvard Business Review or any kind of business or management case study, you're trying to learn from others. An important element of medical education is watching doctors perform medical procedures or other caregivers do their jobs up close. They watch, then they assist, and then, hopefully, they've learned. Who would want a surgeon who says, "This will be the first time I've seen inside a live human body"? It's possible we could follow that example, going to school on the experiences of the people around us. In poker, the bulk of what goes on is watching. An experienced player will choose to play only about 20% of the hands they are dealt, forfeiting the other 80% of the hands before even getting past the first round of betting. That means about 80% of the time is spent just watching other people play. Even if a poker player doesn't learn all that efficiently from the outcomes of the hands they play themselves, there is still a whole lot to be learned from watching what happens to the other players in the game. After all, there is 4 times as much watching everyone else as there is playing a hand yourself. Not only are all those other people's outcomes plentiful, they are also free, aside from any ante. When a poker player chooses to play a hand, they are putting their own money at risk. When a poker player is just watching the game, they get to sit back while other people put money at risk. That's an opportunity to learn at no extra cost. When any of us makes decisions in life away from the poker table, we always have something at risk. Money, time, health, happiness, etc. When it's someone else's decision, we don't have to pay to learn. They do. There's a lot of free information out there. Unfortunately, learning from others is just as fraught with bias. Just as there is a pattern in the way we field our own outcomes, we field the outcomes of our peers predictably. We use the same black and white thinking as with our own outcomes, but now we flip the script. Where we blame our own bad outcomes on bad luck, when it comes to our peers, bad outcomes are clearly their fault. While our own good outcomes are due to our awesome decision making, when it comes to other people, good outcomes are because they just got lucky. As artist and writer Jean Cocteau said, "We must believe in luck, for how else can we explain the success of those we don't like?" When it comes to watching the bad outcomes of other people, we load the blame on them, quickly and heavily. One of the most famous moments in baseball history, in which 40,000 people at a baseball stadium and tens of millions of people around the world instantly blamed an otherwise typical fan for keeping the Chicago Cubs out of the World Series, demonstrates this. The incident is known as the Bartman play. In 2003, the Chicago Cubs were one game from reaching their first World Series since 1945. They led 3-2 in the series against the Florida Marlins and led Game 6 with one out in the top of the 8th inning. A Marlins hitter lifted a foul fly toward the left field stands. At the base of the sloping wall separating spectators from the field, Cubs fielder Moises Alou reached his glove over his head for the ball, as several spectators on the other side of the wall also reached for it. One of the 40,000 spectators at Wrigley Field, Steve Bartman, deflected the ball, which then bounced off the railing, landing at the feet of another spectator. Alou stormed away, expressing anger at the fan who kept him from attempting to catch the ball. The Cubs had a 3-0 lead at the time Bartman, those folks near him, and Moises Alou reached for the foul ball. Had Alou caught it, the Cubs would have been 4 outs from reaching the World Series. Here's how the future unfolded after Bartman touched the ball. The Cubs lost the game, end game 7-2, failing again to reach the World Series. Bartman got the blame. First from the 40,000 people present, who pointed and chanted, "A-hole," threw beer and garbage at him, and yelled death threats. Then from the millions of Cubs fans, not just on sports and news shows replaying the incident at the time, but for more than a decade. One person who actually assaulted Bartman while he was surrounded by stadium security said, "I wanted to expose him for ruining what could have been a once-in-a-lifetime experience." Steve Bartman had a bad outcome. He reached for the ball, and the Cubs eventually lost. Was that due to his bad decision-making or bad luck? To be sure, he made the decision to reach for the ball, so there was some skill in that. He also, however, had an overwhelming amount of bad luck. Almost uniformly, people discounted that bad luck, blaming Bartman for the loss of that game and the series itself. Alex Gibney's ESPN documentary on the Bartman play, Catching Hell, displays the double standard, showing the replay from numerous angles and interviewing spectators and members of the media from the scene. Gibney noted, and the footage clearly showed, there are a lot of people who went for that ball. One fan who lunged right next to Bartman for the ball couldn't deny that he had reached for the ball, the same as Bartman. "I went for the ball. There's no way. I obviously went for the ball." Yet he tried to claim that, unlike Bartman, he would never have interfered with the play. "Once I saw Moises Alou's glove, I had no interest in the ball." That fan at once took credit for his good outcome in not having touched the ball and placed blame squarely on Bartman's decision-making rather than bad luck. While everybody in the vicinity behaved the same way, Bartman was the unlucky one who touched the baseball. But the fans didn't see it as bad luck. They saw it as his fault. Worse yet, none of the subsequent things that happened in the game, all clearly outside Bartman's control, mitigated his responsibility. Remember that after that ball landed in the stands, the Cubs were in the same position they were in before the Bartman play. They still had the Marlins down to their last 5 outs with a 3-0 lead in the game, their ace pitcher hurling a shutout, and a 3-2 lead in a best-of-seven series. That batter who hit the foul ball was still at the plate with a 3-2 count. The Marlins went on to score 8 runs in the inning, 7 of them after 2 batters later, the Cubs shortstop, Alex Gonzalez, bobbled an inning-ending double play ball for an error. Bartman had a lot of bad luck to end up with that result, much of which had to do with the play of the team, over which Bartman clearly had no control. The fans, nevertheless, laid all the blame on Bartman rather than on, say, Gonzalez. Nearby fans yelled, "Rotten hell, everyone in Chicago hates you, you suck." As he walked through the concourse, people yelled, "We're gonna kill you, go to prison. Put a 12-gauge in his mouth and pull the trigger." It would be nice if a storyline developed that gave Steve Bartman credit for the Cubs winning the World Series in 2016. After all, Steve Bartman was a key player in the chain of events responsible for a moribund franchise, hiring baseball turnaround specialist Theo Epstein as president of baseball operations, and Joe Maddon as manager. Not surprisingly, that narrative hasn't gotten any traction. We see this pattern of blaming others for bad outcomes and failing to give them credit for good ones all over the place. When someone else at work gets a promotion instead of us, do we admit they worked harder then and deserved it more than we did? No, it was because they schmoozed the boss. If someone does better on a test at school, it was because the teacher likes them more. If someone explains the circumstances of a car accident and how it wasn't their fault, we roll our eyes. We assume the cause was their bad driving. When I started in poker, I followed the same pattern and still fight the urge in every area of my life to this day. Even though I was quick to take credit for my own successes and blame bad luck for my losses, I flipped this when evaluating other players. I didn't give other players enough credit for winning, or, viewed another way, give other players credit for my losing. And I was quick to blame their losses on their poor play. When I first started, my brother gave me a list of cards that were good to play, written on a napkin while we were eating in a coffee shop at Binion's Horseshoe Casino. I clutched this napkin like I was Moses clutching the Ten Commandments. When I saw people win with hands that were not on my brother's list, I dismissed it as good luck since they clearly did not know how to play. I was so close-minded to the thought that they might deserve credit for winning that I didn't even bother to describe these hands to my brother to ask him if there might be a good reason they would play a hand off the list. As my understanding of the game grew over time, I realized the hands on that list weren't the only hands you could ever play. For one thing, only playing hands on the list meant you would never bluff. My brother gave me that list to keep me, a total novice, out of trouble. He gave me that list because the hands he was telling me to play would limit the mistakes a total beginner might make. I didn't know that, depending on all sorts of factors, sometimes there are hands that wouldn't be on the list that would be perfectly okay to play. Even though I had access to the list writer, I never asked my brother why these guys were playing these off-list cards. My biased assessment of why they were winning slowed my learning down considerably. I missed out on a lot of opportunities to make money because I dismissed other players as lucky when I might have been learning from watching them. To be sure, some of these people shouldn't have been playing those hands and were actually playing poorly. But as I figured out almost a year into playing, not all of them. The systematic errors in the way we field the outcomes of our peers comes at a real cost. It doesn't just come at the cost of reaching our goals, but also at the cost of compassion for others. Other people's outcomes reflect on us. We all want to feel good about ourselves in the moment, even if it's at the expense of our long-term goals. Just as with motivated reasoning and self-serving bias, blaming others for their bad results and failing to give them credit for their good ones is under the influence of ego. Taking credit for a win lifts our personal narrative. So too does knocking down a peer by finding them at fault for a loss. That's Schadenfreude, deriving pleasure from someone else's misfortune. Schadenfreude is basically the opposite of compassion. Ideally, our happiness would depend on how things turn out for us, regardless of how things turn out for anyone else. Yet, on a fundamental level, fielding someone's bad outcome as their fault feels good to us. On a fundamental level, fielding someone's good outcome as luck helps our narrative along. This outcome fielding follows a logical pattern in zero-sum games like poker. When I am competing head-to-head in a poker hand, I must follow this fielding pattern to square my self-serving interpretation of my own outcomes with the outcomes of my opponent. If I win a hand in poker, my opponent loses. If I lose a hand in poker, my opponent wins. Wins and losses are symmetrical. If I field my win as having to do with my skillful play, then my opponent in the hand must have lost because of their less skillful play. Likewise, if I field my loss as having to do with luck, then my opponent must have won due to luck as well. Any other interpretation would create cognitive dissonance. Thinking about it this way, we see that the way we field other people's outcomes is just a part of self-serving bias. Viewed through this lens, the pattern begins to make sense. But this comparison of our results to others isn't confined to zero-sum games where one player directly loses to the other, or where one lawyer loses to opposing counsel, or where one salesperson loses a sale to a competitor.